This week's episode of War Rocket Ajax is brought to you by Loot Crate. Head over to lootcrate.com/warrocketajax and use the coupon code WARROCKETAJAX to get $3 off a new subscription.
Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
Is that War Rocket Ajax? To bring back his body?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to War Rocket Ajax. This is the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast, and we are your hosts. My name is Chris Sims, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Mr. Matt Wilson. Matt, how are you?
Chris, I am doing well. I hope you are, too.
How's the iced coffee working out for you, bro?
You know what? I'm enjoying it a lot. I have used that entire bottle of vanilla syrup already.
Okay, I want to point out that it's only been a week since the last time we talked, and I do not think those things are supposed to be used that much.
It's not a huge bottle. It's a relatively small bottle. And, like, the serving size on the bottle is, like, crazy. It's, like, 2 ounces is a serving. And I do not put that much into each glass of coffee I drink. But I have been drinking coffee out of these, like, this huge plastic glass with a built-in straw, so that probably has been adding to it.
Which cartoon character is on this glass?
There are none. The cartoon character of an arrow pointing up.
Oh yes, Up Arrow, my favorite.
That's right.
He's always on top.
Well, I'm glad everybody got their coffee update right here up front.
But coffee situation. It's the hottest new segment on War Rocket Ajax. But we have a great show for everyone that goes well beyond that. We are going to be talking to Ryan North on this week's episode. He is, of course, the writer on Unbeatable Squirrel Girl from Marvel Comics. But he's also coming up as the new writer on Jughead. And he has a new Choose Your Own Adventure book coming out. Well, excuse me, a new Choosable Path adventure game book coming out called Romeo and or Juliet that we're going to be talking about. Plus, we're going to be reviewing DC Rebirth in a few minutes. So.
That's right. It's legally distinct from Choose Your Own Adventure.
Very legally distinct.
But before we get to any of that, Chris, it's time to thank our newest supporters on Patreon.
Ah, my faves.
These are people who went to patreon.com/warrocketajax and have kicked in a few dollars to help us out. Help us keep the lights on. There's only one name to read out this time around. It's Kevin McLean.
Oh, thank you, Kevin.
If you're like Kevin and you help us out on Patreon, you get cool exclusive stuff for Patreon supporters. Just this week, 2 bits of bonus audio went up. Chris and I talked about the Extreme Rules pay-per-view. We talked about Captain America Civil War. We had an extra little bit from our interview with Chip Zdarsky. We talked even more about coffee, and we talked about movie theaters. All that stuff only for Patreon supporters this week, and we'll have more bonus content to come in the near future. I believe there will be some bonus content from this week's interview with Ryan North, in fact. All right, Chris, those are our Patreon supporters. If you would like to help us out on Patreon, by the way, go to patreon.com/warrocketajax, kick in a few bucks. Chris, let's get to other business and do some checks and wrecks.
Let's do it.
Chris, what are you checking in with this week?
Matt, I'm doing it. I'm going for it. I'm doing the thing we've been talking / threatening to do for a couple months now. I'm doing mystery boxes.
Yeah.
All right. Here's the deal, everybody. Here's the deal. I'm planning for a move later this year. A move to a different state, to a new home. Something that I'm very excited about. But moving means 2 things. One, I need money to move. So thank you for going to patreon.com/warrocketajax and helping to support the show. And going to your local comic book store and buying X-Men 92. Thank you for doing all that. But I need some money to move. And I need less stuff to move. I have so much stuff, and so many of it is books. So much of it is books. And books are heavy, especially comic books. They're in boxes. You got like 200 of these things in a box. It's terrible. It's the worst. So here's what I'm doing. If people were around when I moved a couple years ago, I did kind of an online yard sale where I just put up a list of things and people could email me and I would send them the stuff. And it actually worked out really great. Like, I didn't have to go to eBay for a lot of stuff. I didn't have to go and get, like, you know, pennies on the dollar from a comic book store, which, look, I was a retailer and I totally understand you got to make money. And honestly, there's probably a lot of stuff that I'm going to be schlepping up to a comic book store and hoping they give me $5 or $10 for it. But in the meantime, what I'm going to do, and you tell me if you think this is a good idea, Matt, because I guess we'll find out. I have a ton of comics, and some of the stuff that I have, I'm going to be, like, actually, like, selling individually. Like, I have the first couple of in-universe appearances of Harley Quinn. Those are – now's the time. You know, I've got a run of Invincible from 1 to 60 that I'm probably going to be selling for, because those seem to go for a fair bit of money. I've got some, you know, I've got some Kirby comics that I have in multiple forms. And honestly, a lot of this stuff is stuff that I have in multiple forms. But I also have, like, just boxes and boxes of the kind of comics I like to read. your Marvel 2-in-1 annual number 7s, you sure. know?
The comics you go dive for at conventions.
Yeah, like, I'm a person who bought 2 full runs of Punisher 2099 because I forgot I already had one. I've got stuff that doesn't quite fit as part of a run. I've got pieces of runs that I've never completed. I've got comics I've bought for Bizarro back issues and written about, and now I just have some Jade Man comics laying around that I don't really need. So I figured I would get into the mystery box game. 10 comics pulled seemingly at random from my long boxes, and put in an envelope for you, the listener, for $15. $15 including shipping. So, you know, that covers you're basically getting $10 books and an envelope and shipping and a trip to the post office. Now, I'll tell you, you might get 10 issues of Sonic the Hedgehog, because I got a lot of those. I got a lot of Archie books. I have every book that Archie's published. You might get 10 issues of Sonic Universe. You probably won't. I'll probably try and mix it up a little bit. But this is a little experiment that I'm going to do. I'm probably going to keep doing this for the duration while I raise money, but I figured I'd say it here on Ajax in case anybody out there wants to try their hand, because we've talked about mystery boxes. We've talked about us selling our stuff. You know, I'll let you know when I do it, and I put up, like, the list of, like, graphic novels and trade paperbacks and stuff that I'm going to sell. But for now, I want to see how this mystery box thing works out. Now, these are comics I own. There's going to be some Bizarro back issue stuff in there. There might be some Jimmy Olsen's in there. Matt, do you think this sounds like a good idea?
Well, I think it's already a step above the mystery boxes we talked about a while back, because you know you're getting comics. Yeah. At the very least. They may not be, you know, you may not want 10 Sonic issues, and that's probably not what you're going to get, but at least they're comic books.
Yes.
Which have some inherent value in them already, and we know our listeners love comic books. It could be a fun thing to do if somebody wants to just, like, roll the dice and get, you know, 10 random comics in the mail. I remember back in the 90s-ish, you could go into a bookstore and they were just these, like, in these, like, hard plastic cases, just like 4 issues of comics that you could get somehow, like, that randomly thrown into this plastic case. And you saw the 2 on the outside, but the 2 on the inside were just whatever you got.
See, that's what I'm thinking of. I think it's less mystery box. It's certainly not a loot crate situation. There are no exclusives that you're getting here. It seems like it might be more of a value pack situation.
It's a value pack situation. I remember this didn't happen to me, but I remember that my friend Sean Gerard, this is why my, like, go-to joke issue of a comic to use as, like, a joke about junk comics is Alpha Flight number 100, because yeah. My friend Sean Gerard got, like, 25 copies of Alpha Flight number 100 from buying those packs. I got all the first issues of Heroes Reborn through those packs.
You got some jumping on points.
That's right.
Look, I'm going to tell you, I got a long box of Valiant stuff. I got a long box of Archie. So if you're into Jughead and Ninjak, like I am into Jughead and Ninjak. What did you call him, Matt? You didn't call him mystery boxes. What did you call him?
I called him junk trunks.
Yeah, the Chris Sims junk trunk.
But they're not really that either, because it's just a sealed envelope of comics. I want to know when the Jughead Ninjak crossover is going to happen.
God, the things I would do to write that. So here's the deal: if you want one of these, email me Chris Chris at THE-ISB.com. Put mystery box in the subject, and we'll, you know, if you're interested, good. If you do not want my online yard sale comics, I get it. Not everybody wants $10 books, but you know, I think there's going to be good stuff in there. There's going to be weird stuff in there. There's going to be stuff that you will not understand why I own it. It's all going to be stuff in there, and you'll be helping me out. Chris at the-isb.com, mystery box in the subject line if you want to get in on this. Matt, what is your check this week?
As I've been doing for the past several weeks, my check this week is going to be another book update. As you know, I'm writing a book. I have to have it finished by October so it can be released next year. It is called Supreme Villainy: The Life and Deaths of King Oblivion, PhD. And this week, I surpassed the halfway point of the first draft, which I feel like is a pretty decent accomplishment. I've got to get to north of 80,000 words, and I crossed the 40,000 word mark this week. As of this recording, probably by the time this episode goes up, I'll have done this, but I've actually got a little more to add in to the chapter I'm just finishing up, which will actually put me at the halfway mark. It feels really good to have accomplished having written half this book. It's also, I also think sometimes, like, I got to do all that I just did one more time to be finished. Like, I'm only halfway done. Jesus Christ. But being halfway done feels pretty good, and I'm chugging along. Hopefully I can have the actual first draft done. My plan is to have it done sometime in August so I can do some editing before I have to send it on to the publisher in October. But I'm happy with it. I think it's going to be funny and people are going to like it. I hope so anyway. All right, that's book update, which means, Chris, it's time for us to make some recommendations. What do you have to recommend?
My recommendation this week, Matt, last week you talked about two albums, and you talked about a couple of albums that everybody knows about.
Sure.
They're hits. You talked about Lemonade.
That's right.
I'm talking about an album that I think everybody probably already heard about, but this album should have been a bigger hit.
Okay.
I'm talking about Carly Rae Jepsen's Emotion.
Are you talking about E-mo-tion?
Yes, I am. The terribly punctuated title, because shun, like T-I-O-N, should not be on its own. It looks really weird and it's distracting, but this is a good album. Now, Matt, you know I like pop music. Aiden and I, we had our anniversary last week, and so we ended up kind of going on a little road trip to the beach. We went down to Charleston. First we went to Myrtle Beach, but it was bike week, so we then just drove south. Because bike week, when you are not a biker, is not fun. Like, Myrtle Beach is barely fun at the best of times, but I wanted to see all the chintzy, touristy stuff. And so we've been listening to a lot of the McElroy Brothers podcast, which I believe you are familiar with.
Yeah, I know my brother and me. Do they have like a tabletop gaming podcast too? Maybe.
Yeah, we've been getting pretty super into the Adventure Zone, which is the one that they do where they play D&D with their dad.
Okay,
which it's pretty great because like, I mean, Subrec, that show is awesome because they have a lot of like really fun adventures. Not my favorite actual play podcast. Favorite actual play podcast still Campaign. Shout out to Kat and James, JPC, and Lenik. I forget who plays Lenik, sorry. We were listening to that, and then there was we were, of course, talking about all the vape shops at Myrtle Beach. And there's a video of Griffin McElroy called Vape Tricks. He's like, yeah, this is my new vape rig. Like, he's vaping, but it's a melodica. And he plays the opening to Carly Rae Jepsen's Runaway, which is the first track off of Emotion, which then led us to listening to all of Emotion. And I gotta say, Carly Rae Jepsen, Call Me Maybe, great song. Like, you know it is. Don't try to fight me on this. Great song. Emotion has four songs that are stone cold pop music hits. Four. Like, the whole album's solid, but it has four that should be, like, number one summer jams. If you have not checked out Emotion, you gotta do it. You gotta do it. You gotta. Because it apparently not the hit album everyone was expecting. And I don't understand that. I don't get it.
I always just wondered if the way that that album title was punctuated was a reference to the last track on Daft Punk's Human After All. Where a robot sings Emotion. Exactly.
Emotion.
Exactly punctuated. Exactly, like, you know, broken up into syllables like that album title.
Yeah. I mean, look, that's also an album you should check out. So look, Lemonade, Human After All, and Carly Rae Jepsen's Emotion. That's, like, look, that's a hell of a road trip you just planned.
That's right.
Matt, what's your rec this week?
My rec is the film Keanu.
Ooh, I want to see that.
Starring Keegan-Michael Key. Really fun movie. I actually saw it a few weeks ago, but I left town, and then I had music to talk about, so I didn't get to around to it until just now. I think it's probably still in theaters, but if you can't catch it in theaters or haven't caught it in theaters, it is absolutely worth a rental when you can do that. It is very fun, really funny. Method Man, really great in it. Method Man plays a drug lord / crime boss named Cheddar, which sounds like a direct reference to his character from The Wire, whose name was Cheese. It is ostensibly about a little kitty cat and Jordan Peele wanting to get his little kitty cat back. That is like the driving force of the movie, but there is a lot more going on in it than that. There is a whole lot of Keegan-Michael Key singing George Michael in that movie. And it is glorious. There's a fantastic drug trip / dream sequence. And some shockingly really well shot and well done action sequences in Keanu. Like, shootouts and car chases happen in that movie. Also, Will Forte is in it, and it's very funny. It's one of my favorite comedies that I've seen in a while. To the point where I went and actually saw it in the theater. Part of why I went and saw it in the theater is because my wife Marlene just wanted to freak out about the little kitty cat a lot. And trust me, she did.
I like that between Legends of Tomorrow and Keanu, the word kitty cat has re-entered our collective vocabulary.
Well, I've been talking about kitty cats with Arrow as well. Thank you so much for this season being over. But the part of this season involves people doing magic, and when they do magic, their eyes turn yellow, and it just makes them look like kitty cat people. And it was the only thing I liked about the season of Arrow, is that people kind of look like kitty cats sometimes. Not recommending Arrow. Don't watch it. All right, Chris, those are our checks and recs. Let's talk about some comics.
Yeah, let's do that.
All right, so I think all we're really going to talk about this week is the 1-2 punch of Justice League number 50 and DC Universe Rebirth number 1. We've talked about so much of the Darkseid War storyline, and you know what it ended up being? It ended up being not quite as much, but it was kind of Trinity War all over again, where it was
a bunch of
characters standing around in the same place for several issues, and then it just led into another thing. Because the whole, like, really the big ending of Darkseid War is that there's a baby Darkseid that gets born. All the superheroes lose their god powers.
Are you talking about my new favorite character?
Baby Darkseid?
Baby Darkseid?
I could be upset about Baby Darkseid, but like, what's more comics than Baby Darkseid?
Oh, no, that's okay. Look, here's my only problem with Darkseid War at this point. My only problem with Darkseid War is that it happened in Justice League. Because if it had happened in any book that was not like the flagship book of DC Comics, it would be like, I can't wait for 15 years from now when we can talk about like, when we can talk about Darkseid War as a back issue, as a thing that we can't believe happened. Because if it was happening anywhere else but the high-profile book, I feel like I would be eating it up. Because it ends in the craziest goddamn way with Darkseid's daughter holding up baby Darkseid and shouting Shazam backwards to use Darkseid as a magic gun. She's holding up this baby and like just holding it up as a weapon.
She's using it to take away people's god powers.
Right, because when you say Shazam backwards, that causes everybody's god powers to fly into a baby.
Yeah, except for the Flash, who is just separated from the Black Racer.
Yeah. And then the Black Racer kills Power Ring, but doesn't really kill Power Ring. The Black Racer kills Volthroom, which is the entity that's inside Power Ring, so the Power Ring can now become a Green Lantern. Like, I read it, and I kind of loved it.
If it had just been this one issue, yeah, it would have been great.
Yeah.
But it had to be preceded by how many issues? Seven?
Oh, God, Darkseid War's like 9 issues long. It's really long.
It had to be preceded by so many issues of just these people standing around in the same place the whole time.
Yeah.
Like, it's just too long. That's the old, like, if it had been shorter, and really if it had just been the events of this issue, right? Because this issue has a recap of everything at the beginning anyway. You know? Like, it has Darkseid and the Anti-Monitor fighting each other at the beginning.
Yeah, that's like, remember when that book was about Darkseid and the Anti-Monitor for a minute, and then Darkseid was a baby? Darkseid, by the way, baby Darkseid is Alexander Luthor and Superwoman's baby from Earth 3.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. And then that issue ends with Grail, who is Darkseid's daughter.
Grail, who is Darkseid's daughter and also an Amazon.
And also an Amazon. And also now Darkseid's adopted mother.
Yep.
Taking baby Darkseid to live in a cave. But then she gets naked and just holds this baby naked in a cave at the end. And she's like, I'm going to raise you to be better than Darkseid. It's bananas.
And then in Rebirth, it's just Naked Grail and baby Darkseid, and that's all we really get of them. We're just kind of reminded that they're there.
Justice League 50 finally hit Limit Break for weirdness.
You always like to joke about how I actually liked Forever Evil. I didn't, but I just thought that the thing about snorting kryptonite was bananas to a point where I couldn't hate it, right?
Yeah, like,
all of Justice League number 50 is so bananas that you kind of can't hate it.
Yeah, Darkseid War as a whole, I do not think was very good. I do not think Justice League number 50 was a very good comic. But I feel like there's so much that happens in Justice League 50 that is, like, I can't tell you about it without, like, losing my shit. And that makes it, like, it is, it's a back issue I would love to find if it was not like the book that it is right now, I think, is the thing, because it's inexplicable.
It's hard not to take Justice League 50 and Rebirth as a whole. Like, Rebirth even has like, hey, read Justice League number 50 before you read this. It also says read Superman 52, which is so unnecessary because, like, It just tells you straight up, hey, Superman's dead. And I was telling Marlene about, like, okay, here's what happens in Rebirth and Justice League 50. I sort of put it into three buckets.
Okay.
There's the bucket of, this looks like it could be fun. This looks like a story that has potential. And I think that is true of the Blue Beetle stuff. I think that's true of the Atom stuff. Because those are just setups of, like, okay, Ryan Choi is going to have to go into basically a kind of microverse to go save Ray Palmer, which sounds like a fun setup for a story. And Jaime Reyes is the actual Blue Beetle who's just kind of being mentored by Ted Kord, who's making gadgetry. That seems like it could be kind of fun. So those two things, I think, you know, despite some reservations that people rightly have about, you know, we have these more diverse legacy characters, but their white counterparts have to come back. Those are valid reservations. But otherwise, I feel like those are fun setups for stories. Okay, my second bucket is dumb, but let's see how it plays out. Okay? The three Jokers thing is the epitome of dumb, but let's see how it plays out.
Oh, man. I will admit one thing about that. They fucking swerved us all.
They swerved us all. And, like, okay, so we had the conversation on this show. Like, how could they do the thing with the Joker's name and make it work? And we kind of came to the conclusion, they can't. Right?
Yep.
Like the best thing it could be is...
they agreed.
Yeah, the best thing it could be is his name's Joker. So they swerve us, and it's not his name at all. It's that there are three of them. Dumb. But... I'm curious.
I am like you, Matt. Like, look, I'm going to read the Batman books. The Batman books are very exciting to me. I think they're. I think what we're going into with Batman, All-Star looks fucking awesome. The Tom King stuff looks great. Detective looks great. It all, like, it's all stuff that I'm really interested in. And you know, I'm going to be there to see it play out anyway. But I do not have high hopes.
I think there's a bucket of, like... absolutely stuff where it's just like wait and see. I think the Wally West Barry Allen stuff is kind of wait and see, like, because partially because of the whole weird element of there being two Wally Wests, and it feels like the new Wally West kind of got his legs cut out from under him immediately because of this.
To be entirely fair, they have said that, you know, I think Wally West, you know, New 52 Wally West is going to be in Teen Titans as Kid Flash. And then White Wally West, you know, 1954 Wally West, is going to be in Titans. I don't know what his code name is going to be. Chad's been calling him Young Adult Flash. But, like, I want to imagine a world where characters and their legacy characters can coexist, but, like, historically speaking, I don't think we've seen that. Maybe you we've seen it in Green Lantern, and, you know, we saw it in in Flash, in the 90s Flash, the Wade Waringo Flash. Jay Garrick was around, and Jay Garrick was frequently in those books. Like, I've gone back and read, you know, I reread the Morrison Miller stuff not too long ago, and Jay Garrick's all over that book. But you know, Impulse is in it. Jesse Quick's in it. Like, Johnny Quick's in that run. Max Mercury's in that run. But there's only one guy who's the Flash. There's only one guy who's the fastest man alive. Yeah. And I feel like I want characters to exist alongside their legacy characters, because that really is a best of both worlds scenario. Like, if we can have a Wally West that's, you know, for lack of a better word, my Wally West. You know, the Wally West who's Dick Grayson's best friend. The Wally West who is the Spider-Man of the DC Universe. I want that. The problem is that we already had, like, we just got a new Wally West, like a year ago. And I've got a lot of worries about that guy.
Yeah. However, I will say, as a fan of 90s Wally West, the stuff about him in Rebirth number one, I think there was maybe a little too much exposition about him in here, like just explaining his whole deal.
Yeah, we got his origin story twice.
Yeah, I don't think the that needs to be in here necessarily, but his arc where he's trying to find his tether, you know, either with Linda Park or whomever he's trying to reach, and then eventually he gets it with Barry. The moment where Barry opens his eyes and says, "Wally," and then they embrace, I liked that moment.
Yeah, you know, Kieran is a big Flash guy, and he was talking about really liking it too. And that, for me, it didn't work. Wally should have never gone to Batman. He goes to Batman because it's a crisis riff. Because in Crisis number one, Barry Allen appears to Batman. In a fight that Batman's having with the Joker. So it's like a total crisis riff. And I'm sick of crisis riffs. I'm so done with them. But like,
does that ruin his moment with Barry?
Well, no. I'm getting to it.
Okay.
This is a complicated nitpick. So first of all, there's that. Like, Wally doesn't have an emotional connection with Batman, and he's going to Batman for a very metatextual reason. And we know it's a metatextual reason because Wally talks about comics. Wally talks about DC comic stories that he did not exist during. Wally shouldn't know what happened in Flashpoint. Wally wasn't in Flashpoint. Wally was erased by Flashpoint. You know, he should not be the guy telling Batman, "Oh, look at the Flashpoint letter from your dad, Thomas Wayne, Flashpoint Batman." Like, from an in-universe standpoint, that doesn't work. And it doesn't work that Wally would go to Batman. Here's the list of people Wally should go to in order. Linda, number one. Barry, number two. And if he goes to a third person, it's Dick. It's his best friend. It's the best man at his wedding. That's a nitpick, I know, and that's a, you know, Chris is a grumpy old comics fan who wants his comics just so. But I feel like there's a lot. It is a very Geoff Johns thing to speak to readers and have the character speak as readers. He did it in Infinite Crisis. Like, what is Superboy Prime but a reader who was dissatisfied with reading all these comics? You know, Superboy Prime, you know, went to live in a little box made of DC comics that he could read, and he didn't like them, and so he got mad. That's the plot of Infinite Crisis. Now we have Wally West off in the Speed Force, which apparently is Comixology. Like, Wally's on the comp list.
Or like, comicvine.com.
Yeah. And you know, Chad was talking about Blue Beetle talking about the Batcave. Like, how does that Ted Kord know about the Batcave? How does that Ted Kord know what the Batcave is? Like, is Batman doing interviews? Do people know about the Batcave? In that stuff, the threads are there to me. All the metatextual threads, which I, you know, honestly, are supposed to be there. Because Rebirth is a comic about DC Comics. And for better or for worse, it's a comic about DC Comics. In a way that, like, requires the characters to have read DC Comics and requires us, the audience, to have read DC Comics. That kills the moment for me when he goes and sees Barry. It's metatextual in a way that doesn't speak to me. In a way that, you know, like, I like metatextual stuff. Like, I've written metatextual stuff that I hope has gone okay. I know from experience that it's a tricky thing to work with. And it pulls me out of the moment when you actually get to something that I think is supposed to have an emotional impact, because you've been telling me for 70 pages at that point that this is a comic book. This is comics. And not this is a story. Like, it takes me out of it. It makes it hard for me to have an emotional connection.
I feel like I was able to compartmentalize that stuff a little more than you. I could kind of look at those beats and those moments individually, because I didn't let the one page, or I guess two pages, where Pandora is killed, that absolutely and exactly reflect when Rorschach dies in Watchmen, have any impact on anything else in the rest of the book. Like, all the Watchmen stuff, and this was going to be my third bucket, which is, I'm just going to ignore this and hope that I can read books where this is not a major part of the story, which is the Watchmen, the frame story at the beginning and end, and then all the direct references to Watchmen that are in the middle, which is generally just in, like, page construction and poses and that kind of stuff.
I'll tell you when I started having a bad time with this book. And that is when page one was a 9-panel grid about a watch.
In case you don't get it.
Yeah. On paper, I agree with this book. You and I, Matt, and our listeners have been silent and complicit in this. Like, we have made great sport of the new 52 DC Universe.
Sure. Sure we have.
The idea of saying, of looking at the universe and kind of realizing that it's broken. And going, okay, well, we got to fix this. Trying to do that metatextually. Part of me appreciates that. Like, part of me is like, okay, well, yeah, then let's fix it. Like, what's the way to fix it? Like, is it to bring back all the stuff? Is it to rebuild the connections between all these characters that we kind of just lost?
That's stated. That's the metatextual stuff that almost drew me out of it. Like, the stated stuff where it was like, well, what did our universe not have? It didn't have love. The love was taken out.
There's a lot of baby throat that was thrown out with the bathwater in the new 52. But I, you know, it's hard to look at this book knowing that people have gone in and made the best of it. You know, there's stuff in the new 52 that I've liked. And I gotta say, like, a lot of that stuff maybe didn't require a reboot. But I like Zero Year a hell of a lot. I think Batman Year One is a better comic, but damn it if I am not thrilled with Zero Year. You know, I've read Year One 100 times. I'll read Zero Year 100 more.
Well, okay, talking about throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah.
The Dark Side baby?
Mazas.
Here's my takeaway from Rebirth and why I came out of it feeling more positive than negative, despite the things I felt negatively about, the details that I felt negatively about. It feels like an attempt to bring back some things that the new 52 lost. Some of those character relationships, some of those emotions that aren't just heroes fighting each other all the time. That sort of got lost in the main line of DC Universe books. Getting some of that back without throwing out everything about the new 52.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because there is stuff about the new 52 that worked. So it's a way to try to marry all that stuff and bring back some stuff that was missing and that the text states was missing. It, as a grand scheme, you know, I can approve that. I can approve of that. We can argue about the details and be annoyed by the details and think that especially bringing in Watchmen is not a great idea.
Can you tell that I've kind of been dancing around it the entire time we've been talking? The thing we can all agree on is that Batman finding the comedian's bloodstained button in the wall of the Batcave is really bad. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it would actually be one thing if it was just Dr. Manhattan. You know, because Dr. Manhattan can go from universe to universe. I wouldn't necessarily want that, but that would be okay. But he outright finds that comedian button.
I'm the person who, I mean, saying I invented the phrase is maybe not right, but you know, I'm the person who likes to talk about the great comics that ruined everything, right? Watchmen.
Yeah. Watchmen,
the greatest comic that has ruined the most. But it ain't Watchmen's fault. And so I feel like bringing in Watchmen as your punching bag.
As the thing that took away our love. As the thing that
ruined comics.
That made us grim, yeah.
I feel like that's a metatextual element that to me reads like a cop out. And
well, here's why. Here's a big reason why.
Uh-huh.
Because the period we're not going back to, the period we're going back to is not pre-Watchmen.
Yeah.
It's the mid-90s.
Yeah. It's 1997 when DC Comics were the best they have ever been or will ever be.
Yeah, which was 11 years after Watchmen.
Yeah.
Well, so you can't say that Watchmen took that stuff away.
If you're going to reject Watchmen and what Watchmen represents and what Watchmen's influence has done, you don't need to bring in the original work. I feel like context is very key here because I feel like there's there's a metatextual argument to be made for Watchmen's influence being and the sort of wrong lessons of Watchmen, you know, ruining comics forever. But I feel like to actually go ahead and say, like, oh yeah, Dr. Manhattan, like, fucked around with the DC universe and that's why everything's bad. I don't understand it, and I don't know how it's going to... I don't know how we're going to get through it and get to another side. Because I feel like what we're going to get is Batman versus Rorschach special. You know, Batman versus Rorschach number one. I feel like we're going to get... You know, Superman's going to punch out Dr. Manhattan and then go back to married life with Lois Lane. And that's bananas. And like, if you want to reject those ideas, you don't have to do it on the page. You can. There's an argument that can be made for it's a thing that makes for a good story because it works in a lot of angles. And God knows that if Superman punches Dr. Manhattan, shit, I'll read it.
I'll reiterate my tweet about Rebirth. Okay, that one thing aside, I thought it wasn't bad. I thought it was pretty good. But that one thing, if it subsumes everything else, which it seems like it could end up doing a lot of – causing a lot of problems. And I agree with you. I don't really know how that becomes a story, like going fully metatextual with it. Two, point two. Okay, Watchmen didn't happen between 1997 and now. It happened before that. But I'll tell you a comic that did happen between 1997 and now that you could probably more accurately blame for taking away our hero's joy.
I bet I know which one you're going to talk about, and I bet it's the bottom-ranked comic on the Every Story Ever list.
So maybe if you want to metatextually fight a story, consider that one.
My frequent problem with DC Comics, and something that I've written about at length before, and that I think holds up if you look at DC as a publisher over the years. DC is very reactive. DC's approach to DC is that it needs to be fixed. And I think context is very important. And honestly, if Geoff Johns, you know, the biggest writer at DC Comics, the guy who writes Justice League, the guy who's kind of in charge of as I understand the chief creative officer position, the guy who's kind of in charge of how the world sees DC Comics, is like, no, they don't need to be so sad. Like, if he's going to say that, you know what, I'm all for it. And God damn it, Geoff Johns can do those kind of stories. Those are the best things he writes. When Geoff Johns writes a Superman story and Superman does Superman stuff, it's good, good stuff. If I sound cynical and I sound skeptical, I think I have a right to be, because this is the third reboot of the DC universe that guy has written. I know he's not an editor, and I know that he doesn't, you know, choose the direction of the universe, but also we've got 5 years of Justice League kind of backing us up and of heroes being grumpy with each other. And I'm all for that guy changing his mind, but again, I feel like context is important. And I feel like in this context, my trust has to be earned back.
All right, Chris. Now that we have talked about some comics, it's time for us to talk a little bit about Loot Crate. The May Loot Crate has come and gone, but the June Loot Crate is just about to come out. And I believe we have a few details about that June Loot Crate coming hot off the presses.
If anybody out there got the May Loot Crate, there was an Infinity Gauntlet Oven Mitt in there, which is fantastic. That is amazing. Like, that's one of my favorite things that I've seen. That's the kind of thing you're getting with Loot Crate. May's theme was power, so that fits right in. And I love that because it's something like I would use all the time cooking, but also something that fits the theme. It's something like cool. It's something limited. I've never seen an Infinity Gauntlet Oven Mitt before. But June's theme, Matt, I'm excited about this one. Dystopia.
This is full of stuff about stuff we have talked about on this program many times. I have recommended BioShock games.
Yes.
We have talked at length about Fallout games.
My fave.
Both hosts. There's RoboCop stuff in this Loot Crate.
Yeah, you know who likes RoboCop a hell of a lot? Me and Matt, I really identify with Bobby.
Terminator 2 Judgment Day, there's stuff about that in here.
Not as big a fan of that one as I am of RoboCop, but still pretty good.
Still pretty good. And there's Matrix stuff in this box. There is so much cool stuff in this box to let you experience Brave New Worlds and Societies. You have until June 19th at 9 p.m. Pacific to put in for your new subscription with Loot Crate to get this box. And for less than $20, you can get exclusive, super cool stuff. Stuff as cool as an Infinity Gauntlet oven mitt, which is cool and handy.
If power meant that you got an Infinity Gauntlet oven mitt, and we know Dystopia's got a Fallout thing in it, the mind reels. Like, whatever you get. And again, it's like $20, but you can get $3 off by going to lootcrate.com/WarRocketAjax and using the coupon code WarRocketAjax. Make sure you do that by June 19th to get some cool, cool stuff built around Dystopia.
That's right. And do not forget to go to lootcrate.com/WarRocketAjax first. If you do not go to the URL, you cannot use the offer code. So be sure to go to the URL, lootcrate.com/WarRocketAjax, and use the offer code WarRocketAjax. Get your $3 off. Get lots of cool Dystopia stuff in your June Loot Crate. Now it's time for our interview with Ryan North. We've kept him waiting long enough. Let's talk to him.
Joining us for the program this week, we have one of my favorite people to talk to in comics, and someone who is thematically tied to last week's guest. You will know him from his work as the writer of Dinosaur Comics, Adventure Time, Squirrel Girl, has been going for a while and is still going. He is the writer of the upcoming Romeo and or Juliet Choosable Path game book adventure, and the incoming writer of Jughead, Ryan North. Welcome back to the program. How are you tonight?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, I was good.
What happened? What changed?
Here's what happened, Ryan, and here's something that I want to talk to you about. Someone who doesn't follow me on Twitter tweeted at me to tell me, hey, Fancy Dan shows up in the new issue of Squirrel Girl. So I got all excited, Ryan, because I'm a Fancy Dan fan. I'm a fancy man.
I didn't know you were a fancy man. I fixed the character in the book, if you were curious. I fixed him.
You fixed him? Because what I read in Beautiful Squirrel Girl was slander.
I had a different character in that panel initially. The panel in question is Squirrel Girl goes on a bunch of dates, and one of them is with Fancy Dan, and the Deadpool card, which explains every supervillain's powers and weaknesses, is saying that he will take you out to dinner and eat a bunch of food and stick you with the bill, and then say he loves you if it gets some dessert, which sounds saucy when I put it that way.
That is a horrible thing to say about Fancy Dan.
Yeah. Well, I had a different character originally, and I got a note back from my editor saying, this guy is dead. And I said, oh, I didn't find that in my clearly detailed research. So okay, I think he suggested Fancy Dan.
I'm going to pull back the curtain for a second. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to expose the business here. I did talk to Erica about this last night. And so I know who the other character was, and I agree with that wholeheartedly.
See, I feel like you. I've forgotten who the other character was.
I don't think we can say. Can we say? If it's just because he's dead, I think we can say.
Wait, maybe we shouldn't. I'm not sure what I'm revealing, because I've forgotten it already.
Yeah, I love the Enforcers, dude. The Enforcers are the best.
And
Fancy Dan. The thing you said about Fancy Dan. Is that he's not even fancy, which that is ridiculous. He does karate in a suit.
Then he should be called Karate Dan.
No, he's fancy. It's a fancy way of fighting. He's not a brawler like Ox. He's fancy.
I like how you drop Ox like this is a famous Marvel character that everyone knows about. Like, yeah, you know, Ox.
I feel like if people are listening to this show, look, we're in like year 7 of this show. I feel like people know the Enforcers if they've made it this far into this episode.
Yeah, this is a very pro Enforcers podcast. I'll let you know.
Okay. I definitely am familiar with the Enforcers and their activities.
I feel like you might be fibbing to me.
No, what's your favorite Enforcers moment? Because I bet you mine's the exact same one.
Well, you go first, then. We'll see.
No, I don't want to spoil it, because I've read every Enforcer comic. I don't think you have. I don't want to spoil you on stuff you haven't read yet.
My favorite Enforcers moment is when they show up in Carl Kiesel and Kerry Nord's run on Daredevil, and Daredevil tells Fancy Dan that his fancy fighting isn't fancy enough.
This sounds
Daredevil,
like
a much fancier fighter.
Yeah, no, this sounds like a credible moment that probably definitely happened, because he is not that fancy. He's a guy in a suit. Named Dan.
I'm going to ask you this question. It's not as romantic as it's going to sound. What are you wearing right now, Ryan North?
Oh, me? Yeah, I just threw this ensemble together. It was, you know, whatever's on the rack.
Are you saying here's my question. Okay, you're saying because Fancy Dan wears a suit, that means he's not fancy.
So does that mean like,
to be fancy, one must be tuxedo only?
I feel like a regular person wearing a suit is fancy. Sure, if you showed up in a suit, I might call you Fancy Matt. However, if you show up in a suit and you call yourself Fancy Matt, I'm looking for more than just a bespoke suit. It's probably not even bespoke. It's probably just an off-the-rack jobby. I don't know any bad names to call suits, but whatever whatever you call a suit. Like, calling yourself Fancy Dan implies a lot. If you call yourself Superman and you can't fly and shoot lasers out of your eyes, people are like, well, you could be a bit more super.
Okay, but what if Matt showed up in a suit and then Matt was like, hey, check this out, and started doing karate in his suit?
Then I'd say, like, wow, karate suit. Karate suit Dan. Karate suit Matt. Karate suit Chris. These are your names.
No, but a karate suit is something else. A karate suit is a gi. If you said karate suit Dan and then you looked at that guy, you'd be like, he's not wearing a gi. Why is he called that?
I feel like I've upset you on a personal level.
Ryan,
you're
I'm
being
just saying,
forced to recognize that your favorite character is maybe not that fancy.
Ryan, I'm just saying you seem to have very high fancy standards. Because
I do. I'm not going to apologize for it.
Because honestly, if somebody showed up in a tracksuit that just had like a gold stripe on it, I'd be like, that's fancy.
Where'd you get that fancy tracksuit, Dan? Yeah.
I feel like what we've done today is we've
tracksuit Dan.
I feel like what we've done today is we've brainstormed a lot of new designs for Fancy Dan. And yes. I feel like that's a win.
Has Fancy Dan shown up recently outside of Squirrel Girl?
No.
So, if anything, you should be thanking me for keeping this character in the zeitgeist.
You know what? You're right, Ryan North. Thank you for including a Fancy Dan appearance. Also, I feel like Fancy Dan is probably in his 40s and should not be dating Squirrel Girl, but that's a completely different conversation to have.
Yeah, I mean, it was not a good date. It was an ill-advised date.
Matt has brought up your fanciness standards. I believe the last time you were here on the show was when we were talking about your previous Choosable Path adventure game book, which was To Be or Not to Be, the Choosable Path version of Hamlet.
That is the adventure.
Exactly. And you had a moment, you know, we talked about it, and you said that it just came to you because you were just driving around in your car thinking about Shakespeare one day.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's true. It makes me sound fancier than I am. The detailed version of that story, of the Fancy Ryan story, is that I was listening to CBC, which is our national broadcaster here in Canada, and they had an actor on, and she was saying how in the olden days you would memorize soliloquies to go do performances, to go do auditions, rather. And now they want you to audition off of whatever they're performing, like their particular script. And so actors today don't have any soliloquies memorized. And that was what she's talking about. And I was thinking, I'm not an actor, but do I have any soliloquies memorized? And that leads into To Be or Not to Be, which leads into I should write that book, which leads into I should write a sequel to that book, which leads to us talking today about Fancy Dan. All thanks to the CBC.
You just took us through that non-choosable path. That is a. I did not make any choices in that one.
No.
No, but like I was a Kickstarter backer for To Be or Not to Be.
Did I know that? Thank you. I didn't know that, or I'd forgotten. Yeah, I mean,
I was sent a book. We've talked about it previously.
Okay. Thank you again, Chris. It was a memorable exchange.
You know what? Thank you for pretending, at least. Which, by the way, if people out there have not read To Be or Not to Be, literally one of my favorite books of all time.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Like,
thank you.
Before I dropped out of college to spend more time with Batman, I was an English major. My mom was an English teacher.
Fancy.
We are reading some Shakespeare household. There's so much fun stuff in To Be or Not to Be. You know, you put the pirate fight back in it, which I think is the most important thing. I know that it was a stretch goal of like, hey, I will write a sequel to this book. And I think you knew then, if I'm remembering correctly, that you wanted it to be called Romeo and or Juliet.
Oh, no, I didn't. I did not at all.
So that was not part of the campaign? Because I remember that coming fairly early.
So what happened was I had a stretch goal at $100,000, thinking I'll have tons of time. If we reach this, then I'll write a sequel because that seems to be a profitable book. But I thought I'd have... you know, a month before we reached that, and we reached that goal in like 3 hours. So it was really sort of on the spot, and you had to think of something. And I waited till after the book had been shipped out before I started actually seriously thinking about what to do next. And it was sort of my first thought was Macbeth, because the structure of Hamlet, and I'm going to spoil the plot of Hamlet here, so spoiler alert on a 400-year-old play. The structure of Hamlet is Hamlet gets a mission from a ghost to kill Claudius, the final boss, works his way up, kills him, game over. It's very much the structure of a computer game, so it works well for a game book where you're the one making the choices. But Macbeth, the structure is decide to kill a king who's the final boss, do it real quick, and then feel guilty for most of the play or game. And it doesn't work. I thought it wouldn't work especially well in this nonlinear second-person narrative format because... you know, turn to page 5 to feel guilty doesn't seem like much of a fun choice. So I was thinking about Romeo and Juliet, but then I never liked the ending of Romeo and Juliet. And it took me a really long time to be like, wait a minute, I can fix the ending. I can do different endings in this book I want to write. And yes, I'm the guy who's going to fix Shakespeare. I just called myself that by accident.
But, I mean, to be fair, no one likes the ending of Romeo and Juliet, including Shakespeare.
Yeah, it's a frustrating ending by design, obviously. I don't think Shakespeare wrote it and was like, I don't know what I'm doing. I think it was all intentional. But what bothered me is that if Romeo had just, you know, stopped for flowers, then he'd be 5 minutes late. Then when he got to the crypt where Juliet was lying there with her fake death potion wearing off, she'd already be woken up and it would be a ridiculously happy ending. All their problems are solved. And so that was one of the first endings I come up with was let's give them the, you know, ridiculously happy ending if you just stop and pick up flowers. And then I was just writing it. I did a book within a book in To Be or Not to Be, and I did another book within a book in Romeo and or Juliet, and that book within a book is called Fair is Foul and or Foul is Fair, i.e. Macbeth, but really short. So I got them both in the end.
This is a phrase that I've said to – I really only use this phrase with people I respect, and I want you to know that. This is the phrase that I said to Glenn Weldon, who wrote the great book on Batman, The Caped Crusade, and now I'm saying it to you, Ryan North. Here's why I'm wrong, Ryan.
Mm-hmm. I'm right.
Macbeth's my favorite. Macbeth's my favorite Shakespeare play.
Oh, nothing against Macbeth.
Largely because it's the action movie. It's the short one. It's of the major tragedies, it's the shortest one. It's the one with witches and, you know, a guy basically, like, saying a pun in the final battle. But the thing that I think, when you mentioned that you were thinking about Macbeth, the thing that I immediately thought was like, oh, you could have so many playable characters. Because you play as Macbeth, and then you switch to Lady Macbeth, and you can switch to Macduff, and then you switch to Banquo. And
the
like,
witches.
There's so much... And the witches, like, you bounce around, which I know is one of your favorite tricks to pull in these books.
But it's such a constrained, it's a small story in a sense. Like, there's kings and there's all the stuff happening. But the witches, they show up at the start and get things rolling. And then they're kind of gone. They show up a bit, just be like, everything's going fine. All right, see ya. but they're not involved in the play in a major way once they start things rolling, in my opinion. And the thing with Hamlet and with Romeo, those plays, is that the major characters are all kind of there throughout and are involved in different ways. I'm not going to stop you from writing your own Choose Your Own Path Macbeth and just proving me wrong. But I thought it was a less interesting project than Romeo.
People would be very angry at me. I feel like if I came out with my Kickstarter to write a Shakespeare Choose Your Own Adventure book, there would be rocks thrown at my head.
One big thing is, both Romeo and Juliet and Hamlet have so many places that they go. Macbeth is kind of, for lack of a better to put it in modern TV terms, a bottle play.
Like it's a bottle play,
almost all takes place at this one banquet. So you kind of have less options for places to take people than you do with the other plays, I guess.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the fun thing with Romeo and Juliet, that play, is that both the eponymous titular characters are out of the action for long stretches of time. Like, Juliet's knocked out for precisely 42 hours, and Romeo gets banished to Mantua for days, just hanging out there. And so the fun part of adapting is that you have both these characters who sort of disappear for a while, and you have to get to play them and see what they're doing while they're out of focus in Shakespeare's play, which I thought was interesting and fun.
I feel like I should specify for the record that I don't actually think you're wrong. I just really want to see you doing Macbeth stuff. So I'm glad that does exist in R-A-O-J.
R-A-O-J. You get a taste. There's actually two books within a book. There's actually four, if we're going to be generous with it.
Yeah, because I flipped through my copy. I've actually not read it yet. But I've read through To Be or Not to Be, going different ways through it, like at least 10 times. And just flipping through this copy of Romeo and or Juliet, the trick that impressed me so much in To Be or Not to Be was when you had it was a chess game, right? And you had a chess game with no visuals. You had a chess game that you had to keep track of in your head as you played through it. That was Ophelia versus Gertrude. Sometimes I lay awake at night wishing I could be that clever. Just flipping through this one, I guess I should say, in To Be or Not to Be, you had that. You had the murder of Gonzago done as a... Since it's the play within the play, you had the book within the book, which was really cool. But here, you've got Pyramus and Thisbe. You have Nurse Quest. You have a comic... I guess that's Pyramus and Thisbe is a comic like the Choose Your Own Adventure issue of Adventure Time. Mm-hmm. And what is this other one? What is this other one here? Midsummer Night's Choice.
It's pretty good. I just laughed at my own joke in public. How embarrassing.
Was that just a function of knowing people were going to come to this having already read the previous book and being like, well, I gotta top it. I gotta do more.
I'd never written a sequel before, unless you count 13 Years of Dinosaur Comics being sequel to that first dinosaur comic with the same pictures. And so when I started to write this, I was thinking, all right, well, what are good sequels? What makes a good sequel? So I watched Back to the Future 2, which is the best sequel. And if you disagree, I will say that you're wrong. Because it's a movie that literally revisits the first film. It's so good on so many levels. I tried to figure out like what makes a good sequel, and I thought, okay, there's a couple things. One is you want to do the first thing but better, and the second is you want to do the first thing but in a way that you couldn't do it before, in some way that's original. You can't just retread it. You have to make it new and exciting. And so for me, the way of doing that was, well, let's go bigger and better in the sense of instead of one book within a book, there's two, and there's other stuff on top of that. Or once that's done, like let's do some more interesting choice structure, different ways of making choices and making decisions in the book that I hadn't seen before, hadn't come up with before. Which is a very technical answer to a probably very boring answer to a reasonable question. But sometimes I can be boring. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we're done here. Great, Matt. Wrap it up.
Speaking of wrapping it up. I'll make a segue out of that.
Good job.
There's a, you know, one of the selling points of Romeo and or Juliet is that there are over 100 endings. And I assume, my assumption is that many of those endings feature the two characters living instead of dying. If you don't feel like giving that away, you don't have to answer that, okay? That's not the question. But the thing that my mind immediately goes to is that creating so many situations where their two feuding families have to get along. Do you go way beyond, you know, that point in the story in these alternate endings, like way, way far into their future, where we have to find out, you know, where we find out what exactly went down with the Montagues and the
Capulets? Oh yeah. There's endings that go far into the future. There's one that ends in our present day, which is always fun because the conceit of the book is that this was the original book that Shakespeare plagiarized when writing his version of the play. He just ran through it once and stole it, which I love because it sort of implies the audacity of saying Shakespeare plagiarized me, even as a joke, is so ludicrous and so outrageous that I just love saying it. And there, I don't get into the nature of, you know, why these, the Montagues and the Capulets, hate each other as families, because I don't think anyone cares, I think. And also, I don't think there's an answer that satisfies. And here's, it's a zombie example, right? Like, we all know, you see zombie movies. Nobody's there in a seat watching a zombie movie to see their explanation of where zombies come from, because it's never going to work. You're never going to see a movie where a meteor comes by and suddenly zombies exist and someone goes, aha, so that's how you do it. That makes a lot of logical sense. Please proceed. Like, you buy in that zombies exist and no answer will satisfy. And I feel like just buying in, the price of admission is that these two families don't like each other. That's totally fine. That's super fine. Which sort of allows me to segue into this idea I have, my working theory, and you feel free to tell me I'm wrong, but I don't think origin stories work anymore in terms of superpowers. Like, they work in trying to explain where a character comes from, but in terms of where they get their powers, I don't think you can do it. Because you say, like, bit by radioactive squirrel, that reads as a joke. But it works for Spider-Man because he got there first and it was the 60s. You say cosmic rays, it kind of reads as a joke because we know cosmic rays don't do that. And we know, I think there's enough general knowledge of science now that you can't hand wave an explanation for how someone gets any sort of superpowers and have the audience go, uh-huh, of course, that makes sense. Experimental sound waves did it. Of course. So this is the theory I've been developing for a while. I'm just sharing it here for the first time. But I think superpower origin stories might not work anymore. We should all just accept it and move on.
Before we get away from
segue, I for sure.
Here's what I'm envisioning in my mind. Because, like, honestly, I don't care why they hate each other either. Like, it doesn't matter. But I just love imagining, like, if Romeo and Juliet get to the point where they're getting married.
It happens in the play.
And then they have to have that and then they have to have that wedding. Sure.
Yep.
To have that wedding.
Like the pirate scene is cut from Shakespeare's play. You never see them get married. It's so weird. They're like, here we are, off to get married. Then it's like, scene missing. Now we're married.
Just, I could envision a scenario where there could be, it could be mined for comedy, where those families have to interact with each other. But anyway, I don't want you to have to do
anything. Is the question, did I put jokes in my book about that?
That's right. That's
yes,
the question.
Yes, there are some
jokes, Ryan.
I just want to say that I wish I had the life that you have had that has somehow led you to the conclusion that we all just know where what cosmic rays do. Like, how many people have you met that are aware of astrophysics to the point where you're comfortable saying that? Because let me tell you, I have not met that many people.
I'm not sure if you're supposed to talk about other podcasts while you're on someone else's podcast, but A friend of mine does a podcast called Titanium Physicists, and the format is he is a physicist and he knows a lot of physicists. And as he was like, look, people talk about physics. It's hard because as physicists, we assume things that we think people know and they don't. And so the whole podcast is he gets people who don't know anything about physics, and I'm one of them pretty much, to come on and get explained stuff to them while you ask, while I ask, the stupid questions and say, wait a second, like, what is this? What are these cosmic rays, professor? And so I think from that experience, I feel like I have a pretty good working knowledge of cosmic rays. But even without it, like, the lay person must, if they thought about it, realize if cosmic rays really made you either stretchy or flamey or invisible or rocky, surely we would know about it. Because there have been astronauts in the cosmos. The Russians call them cosmonauts.
Ryan, is your problem that you don't find these premises believable?
They're not.
And realistic. You do a comic about talking dinosaurs.
Talking dinosaurs lived 65 million years ago, and to be fair, we only have a handful of skeletons for every species. There's lots we don't know about them, including could they talk or not. They could have built buildings out of meat with no bones, and those wouldn't fossilize. Those would be gone. We'd never know.
And
there's
Ryan's
a car in a tiny room.
However, in Ryan's defense, there is not. He doesn't give the origin of how and why they talk.
That proves me right. That proves my point.
They didn't get hit with any kind of space beam.
We just accept it and we move on. I mean, do you disagree? Do you think that when you pick up a superhero comic with a new superhero, you're thinking, how did this character get those abilities? Tell me how so I can duplicate it. Like, for Batman, his powers are tied to his character and they define who he is. He worked hard and he plays hard, and that's how you get Batman.
I mean, you know,
sure, but with Spider-Man, with John Spiderman, he just has themed powers, and the fact he got a spider bite sometimes is important, but usually isn't that important. It just sort of gives you a hint as to what his powers are, his leaping, his squirting webs at people, things like that. And I don't think it's super important to know that a spider bit him a lot of the time, just that he is a spidered man. And let's all move forward and see what he's up to this week.
I feel like this is the first time I've heard Spider-Man referred to as squirting webs at people, which is way grosser than that should probably. He slings webs. He's a web slinger.
Squirts a web
any
size.
Not a web squirter.
As the song states,
spins. Sorry, wrong verb.
So I do think you might be onto something here, Ryan. But I think that Stan Lee and Jack Kirby were onto this a long time ago, because they're the guys who decided by the time they got to the X-Men, the explanation was just, you know what, they're born with it.
And it's great.
Just forget it. It's just puberty, and they get it then, and that's
it. And
it
works really well. So I guess what I'm saying is, I did not invent this theory. It has been preemptively plagiarized by none other than Kirby himself.
All right, look, you can say this Shakespeare if you off, Ryan, but how dare you bring Jack Kirby into this? That brings up a question that, have there been people, and I'm going to assume there have because we've all been on the internet, but are there people who don't get the joke? Even though it's ludicrous of you to say that this is the choose-your-own-adventure book that Shakespeare made the most boring choices out of.
This is what surprised me until I sort of realized why. I was terrified. I wasn't terrified. I was worried. I was a little bit scared, just a little, that, Shakespeare scholars would be upset with me. And when I say Shakespeare scholar, I'm sure most people picture a stuffy guy looking over his glasses at you in a library or something, and he's not happy. But the people who devote their lives to studying Shakespeare are people who recognize that these are plays that were written to be fun. These are entertainment. These are meant to be entertaining. And they also recognize that I haven't destroyed all extant copies of Romeo and Juliet when I put out my version. It's something that lives on top of that and exists beside it in relation to it. And so everything I've seen from these people have been super enthusiastic. You're you're making it fun. You're bringing attention to it. These are some of my favorite works. I'm so glad people are talking about them. Like it's been nonstop support, which is great. I think Shakespeare scholars are good people with correct opinions.
Is there a Shakespeare scholar in the room right now? You can just say like, yeah, I also like sandwiches.
None besides you, Chris.
Okay. That's right. I'm the one who doesn't get the joke. Like, Ryan, why did you do my favorite Shakespeare play? That's enough about Romeo and Juliet, I think.
Okay. Listen, shut up about that a minute.
look, Ryan, you had a phenomenally – this is the sequel to a phenomenally successful book that, you know
– Yep.
I have recommended this to so many people. I have
thank you.
You know, I've told people like, hey, this is the best gift for literally anyone. If you know a librarian, if you know an English teacher, like if you know people who like comics, they will get a kick out of these books. So
awesome!
I'm glad you're here to talk about it. But I do want to talk about a subject that's near and dear to both me and Matt, and that of course is Forsyth Pendleton Jones III.
The third.
Jughead.
Juggy.
It's very, very exciting to me that you're coming on that book. I'm gonna be honest with you. I wanted to write that book so bad. I was telling Erica, like, when she got the job, I was like, hey, when you guys leave, like, when Chip leaves, like, you know, me and Chad, like, we could write Jughead. Like, just, you know, they know.
Just throw that out there. Yeah.
When we found out that Chip was leaving after number 8, I was like, oh well, they clearly haven't called me, so I'm going to be mad at whoever gets announced. And then it was like, oh yeah, it's Ryan. And I was like, oh yeah, that makes sense. that makes a lot of sense. So I'm very happy for you. I'm super excited about Derek. Derek Charm is
an
amazing artist and a great dude. This is a character who's been around forever, but this is a weird new version of him. In a weird new version of a weird new version of the Archie universe. Like,
right.
Things in Jughead have been established to be a little bit weirder than they are over in Archie at the same time. Mm-hmm. So what's your approach there?
I mean, it's always – first I should ask, like, what did Chip say when he was on last week? The thing with Jughead, and I think Chip and I talked about this beforehand, was – like Jughead has always been to me, he's always been the weird one and the funny one. Like in the Double Digest, he would have the best jokes, and maybe that's just my Jughead bias showing. But he also had like the weird ones where he'd be, you know, Archie is off trying to decide between two women, and Jughead is off, you know, making a painting, and the painting comes to life and chases him around the house. And you're like, Jughead, what are you doing? Like, what? Why is everything so weird around you? It's so interesting. And so for me, Jughead is this at the same time as he's this guy who gets to be a bit weirder than everyone else, he's also this sort of bastion of stability where everyone around him is girl crazy or boy crazy or whatever crazy. And he's like, listen, guys, I like a good burger and I like being Jughead. And those are his two interests. So it's really satisfying, and as a guy who could eat a lot when he was a teen and was afraid of talking to girls, not that Jughead's afraid, but I was afraid, it's not hard to get in his head, right? I like a burger. You like a burger, probably.
So quick question about what you and Derek are doing on Jughead. One of the things that we talked about with Chip last week was that in the two issues that he's doing with Derek, which are kind of the bridge story between his six-issue arc with Erica Henderson and you coming on to be the new regular writer with Derek as the new regular artist, that he's kind of backing away from doing the interstitial fantasy sequences where he did, you know, Jughead's Time Police, he did the Super Teens, all the, you know, weird corners of the Archie universe. Which, by the way, in six issues, he did not exhaust. There are plenty more to go back to. But he said the reason he didn't want to do any in 7 and 8 was to make it a smooth transition in case the next writer didn't want to include those. So my question for you is, are you going to go and be like, oh yeah, we're totally going to throw in a weird Archie's Weird Mysteries sequence or RC Racers? Or Archie 1.
Yeah. I feel like the way Chip was doing that was quintessentially Chip. And so much so that if I were to do it in the exact same way, it would feel like I was just imitating him, right? Because the way he was doing it was so good and so distinctive that I don't think I could do it justice. So I'm not doing it in the same way where, you know, Jughead gets hit in the head or has a nap or changes some liminal state where these sequences happen. But I want to keep that idea of the sense of possibility those sequences give you, in the sense that we're not necessarily always tied to the humdrum reality of reality all the time. I'm not sure I'm explaining it well. This makes it sound like I don't know what I'm doing, but I promise I do.
I need a yes or no.
Okay.
Jingles the
Is that
Elf.
A question?
Jingles the Elf and the Sugar Plum Fairy, will they appear?
Do I have time to send in a rewrite?
Well, on that note of assurance, Chris, I think we should move on to Twitter question.
That's right, Matt. If our listeners would like to get in on the interviews that we do every week, we always love to give listener questions to the guests that we interview. How exactly can they go about that process, Matt?
Well, what they need to do is get in their handy-dandy time machine, head back to the time of one Mr. William Shakespeare, and toss him a copy of Romeo and or Juliet and say, hey, buddy, read through this and get a story out of it. Get a play out of this, because I know you need one. Then, once you have straightened out the timeline, return to the year 2016. Sign up for an account on Twitter.com if you don't already have one. Follow me at the Matt D. Wilson and Chris at the ISB. Wait until Thursday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 6:30 Pacific. One of us will put out the call for questions for our guest, and you can ask a question just like the ones you're about to hear for Ryan North. The first question that we have for Ryan, this comes from Matt Robotham, Robot Matt on Twitter. He wants to know, he says, Ryan's clearly a Choose Your Own Adventure fan. What are some of your favorite Choose Your Own Adventure books, official or otherwise?
I like this idea of bootleg, like underground Choose Your Own Adventure books. I said to you, I was reading one this morning, which makes me sound the opposite of fancy. And it's from their Time Machine series, where you have a time machine. This one's where you go back in time to visit dinosaurs. And I hadn't read it since I was a kid. And so I was rereading it, and the structure is you have a time machine, and every option you can either go back in time some more or forward in time a bit. And it's sort of like a quiz. I think a paleontologist helped write it. So they'll be like, oh, the season flowers here. Should you go forward or back in time? And you have to think, well, when did flowers show up in Earth's development? And you sort of flip to the back to get some clues. So it's kind of a lot of work. But I was playing it, and I found something I'd never found before, where this other time traveler showed up, and I think his name was Ken. Maybe it was Chris, actually. And the other time traveler was like, hey, I'm also a time traveler. Come with me to the future where we'll find some cool flowers. And you're like, I don't know. I'm not sure you know what you're doing. So I went with him, and he didn't know what he was doing. He brought us back to the present, where we were in a bookstore reading the very book that we had in our hands, and we got kicked out because this wasn't a library, and we already cracked the spine. And so I had to restart the book again from the beginning. And I was like, that was pretty good. I enjoyed that meta twist with it.
Yeah, that sounds like an ending you would write.
Yeah, I was. Hopefully I didn't subconsciously plagiarize it for something I read 30 years ago, but it was really good.
The next question that we have is from Getter404 on Twitter. They want to know, did you have to endure some sort of Thunderdome-like duel to the death with Chip Zdarsky to get the Jughead gig?
Oh, no. We do those on the regular just for funsies. So it was no big deal.
This question comes from Xavier Files on Twitter, the Xavier Files podcast, or blog, I should say. They want to know, why aren't T-Rex and Utah Raptor dating? And hashtag one true pairing.
I thought this would be a softball question. The real answer is very early on in the first year, I had them fighting. And I found the comic very difficult to write during those three issues where it happened, three installments, because the first three panels, Utahraptor's not there. And to have some, to have these characters fighting and have the other, one of the characters in the fight not be present for half of that fight every single time made it really tricky. And so making them date sort of puts us in the same position where if they're in this, you know, loving, committed relationship, but he's only ever there for half of it, it's too... I don't want to say it's too hard, because that makes me sound like I'm not good at stuff, but it's a challenge as yet unmet by my considerable skills, which makes me sound egotistical. So let's just say, I don't know, maybe someday...
All right, the tease. Keeping it, you know, you don't want to pay off on that tension too quickly.
Yeah, no, it's been 13 years, but I think figure a little bit more. Let's do a bit.
Yeah. Next up, this question comes from Lexifab on Twitter. Can you tease your next Choose Your Own Adventure Shakespeare project? How will you get laughs out of Titus Andronicus?
Oh, I just finished the one. Let me relax a bit. But honestly, my dream project would be Cymbeline, which is Shakespeare's least performed play. It's really unpopular. I saw it performed a couple years ago, and it was amazing. And also bonkers. Like, the first half, you have this character, Cymbeline, who's really interesting and really... she's literally a powerful, confident female character. And then halfway through, she gets a cold and she has to lie in bed for the rest of the play. She just like drops out. She's completely sidelined. It's like they mush two plays together. Then at the very end, a god shows up. I think it's Saturn, and sorts it all out. Literal Deus Ex. And it reads like a bonkers first draft, but it's Shakespeare. So it has this beautiful language in it with this plot that is incredibly bizarre. Doing Cymbeline would be fun, but I don't think anyone would ever want to read it because probably no one even knows that play exists. Well, no one listening. I don't want to say that. That sounds like an insult. It's not a popular play. Most people aren't aware of it.
The Shakespeare scholar who's in the room with you definitely is familiar, I'm sure.
Listen, man, be cool.
James D. Leach on Twitter wants to know, has the time that you were stuck in the hole influenced your work at all?
I like that without any context, that sounds even more interesting. But yes, I was stuck in a hole, and no one spends that much time in a hole and exits a hole and is the same man they were going into the hole. But the serious answer is, I don't know. I feel like if I ever need to write a character stuck in a hole, I am set. And I also feel pretty proud that sometimes when you look at Google autocomplete, it's Ryan North height, Ryan North tallest man, and I've seen a couple times Ryan North hole, which is a really amazing autocomplete score, and that is my true legacy.
I would think that being in a hole would help you with choose your own story, choose your own adventure types of things, because what can you do in the hole other than think of all the possibilities of what might happen to you eventually in that hole?
Yeah, and the choices you made that led you to being stuck in a hole.
That's right. Tales to Enrage on Twitter, our friend Greg Black, wants to know, when you came up with Iron Man splaining, did you just take the rest of the day off?
I'm working on the Squirrel Girl graphic novel, pardon me, at the same time as the Squirrel Girl Monthly, and the Iron Man splaining thing was in the graphic novel, and I came up with it like, this is good, but it couldn't quite fit. And then I was working on the recap page for the monthly the next day, and I was like, no, this is where it belongs. This is perfect for it. # Iron Man splaining. And I was sort of worried that Marvel would say, like, what are you doing? No. But they said, what are you doing? This is great. And printed it, and I was relieved.
Alexandria Seal on Twitter wants to know, what animal species would each of you have the ability to communicate with?
Ooh, I'm going for dogs. That's taken. What about you guys?
Matt, do you have one? Matt, you're a cat owner.
But I really only I really only like my cat. I'm not like a, I'm not, I'm like, I like my cat and not necessarily all other cats. I think I would want to communicate with bears just in case I ever ran into a bear and I could say, hey, I'm cool. Leave me alone.
My bad.
Yeah.
Do you mean,
don't hurt me, bear.
Do you, okay. You're planning for a rare eventuality.
I live I live in a town with lots of bears.
I mean, yes, you do. You live in a bear area or baria.
That's right.
But I feel like the number of like you're talking about avoiding becoming a bear fatality, right?
Yeah. It, well, look, if my power can help me avoid death one time, it's worth it.
Yeah, but I feel like that's like.
But do you run into a lot of bears?
I could easily run into a bear tomorrow.
When you say could, do you mean like you know how and you're just holding off till you learn how to speak to bears?
That's right.
Like you're tight with bears and you're just waiting for your chance.
No, I'm saying I could go downtown and there could be a bear in a parking lot.
There could be a bear in a
permissive sense?
Downtown in a parking lot?
There have been. There have been bears rummaging around in dumpsters.
Okay, well, here's what you do.
Asheville, North Carolina.
You just don't get out of your car at that point, because you're in a car if you're in a parking lot. And while bear beats human, I do feel like car beats bear.
All right. Well, that's enough bear discussion. Chris, we need your species.
My first thought is birds. Because I feel like birds, you know, they're kind of everywhere. They could carry messages for me. But also, I have texting, and I like Bojangles a lot. So I think it would be weird if I could talk to birds if I ate as much chicken as I do.
Oh, yeah.
So...
Yeah, that's...
Like...
That's a problem we dog and bear people don't have.
Yeah, like, I...
That's right.
I don't want to talk to cats, because, like...
What are they going to say anyway?
I'm allergic to cats. Like, I don't want to be around cats. Like, the only thing I would want to say to a cat is, like, hey, go away. I can't breathe when I'm around you.
And they won't listen.
And they won't listen. Because, like, even cat people know that cats are jerks. You know what? Squirrels. There we go.
Ooh.
There we go.
Go on.
You got to steal a gimmick.
Why?
The longer I think about it, the more sense it makes. They're not an animal you eat.
Some people do.
They're not an animal I eat, I should say.
Yet.
Infringing on a gimmick over there, Chris. Good job.
Yeah, I'm going to do it.
All right, this is going to be our last question. This is another for everybody question.
Okay.
This is from One Word Long on Twitter. He wants to know, to everyone, if you had just one bottle to put a message in, what would it say? And I feel like the unspoken context of this is, you're on like a remote island. You're somewhere where you can only communicate via this message in this bottle.
And we're sharing the bottle, the three of us?
No, I think we each have a bottle.
Okay. So I can write like, don't listen to those other bottles. You want to rescue the tall guy.
Chris, do you have a ready, set, bottle message?
I mean, no. Like... I don't have like an innate knowledge of like coordinates. Like I feel like that's a thing comic books lied to me about, was that when I was an adult I would be able to instantly recognize coordinates. That is not a thing I can do.
I like how you're using coordinates as like this sort of mysterious object that is unknowable. Like, what are coordinates? We just don't know. But we do know. It's just two numbers that describe a position on a sphere.
But it's not like I could, like, I mean, look, I could learn what coordinates are, but Ryan, I'm not going to.
You know what coordinates are, just like you know cosmic rays don't give you stretchy powers.
No, but I'm talking about,
you know what latitude and longitude are. Those are coordinates. You know coordinates.
Yeah, I know the definition of coordinates. I don't know what coordinates I am at right now.
Yeah, but you know you're north of the equator, yeah.
Oh, well, good. That's going to narrow it down. That's really going to get people to my desert island.
You just narrowed it down by half. You keep doing that six times, you'll be in a pretty good location.
If I do that six times, that's still a very large piece of the Earth.
Okay.
I'm saying you're not a babe in the woods with coordinates. You know coordinates, just not a detail you feel comfortable with. But you can do this, Chris. I believe in you.
So, Chris, what you're saying is you want your bottle message to say, help me learn coordinates.
Yes. Please teach me coordinates.
All right.
The recipe is just question marks.
My bottle message is the classic cheat. And my bottle message is going to say, send more bottles.
Matt eats bottles. I don't know if everybody right. knows that.
I mostly like eating bottles.
Matt is a carnival man who eats glass.
My bottle, does it say write or stick in the bottle? Can I just put in like a long length of string and then just say follow the string to find me?
I don't know why you would need to do that since you know so much about coordinates.
Just, well, I'd say I'm north of the equator.
Yeah, just tell them what sixth of the world you're on.
No. See, doing sixth is more than a sixth of the world.
I know what it does.
Which, what you're saying to me right now is you know coordinates.
I have one more question. I am Erica Henderson, our mutual friend, and I asked her if she has any questions for you. She did get back to me. This is her question. Ryan, when can I draw Dazzler?
So we're working on the Squirrel Girl Beats Up the Marvel Universe OGN, and I just realized, as we're speaking, I have not put Dazzler in that book. And I feel like the whole reason Erica wanted to do this was, if you beat the Marvel Universe, Dazzler's part of the Marvel Universe, she'll at least make an appearance. So I need to go do some quick rewrites here to salvage my relationship.
Well, we'll let you get to that, but before you do run and do that, Ryan, please let all our listeners know where they can find you on the internet.
Yeah, you can find me at dinosaurcomics.com, or I have a new site, ryannorth.ca, that has links to all my stuff, including the crazy stuff like where I reviewed the Back to Future novelization page by page for 8 months.
I own
four choices, and I made mine.
And it is fantastic.
Thank you.
It's one of my favorite things you've done.
Everyone's go reading. Read it for free. It's a Tumblr. And also you can buy the ebook, which is nice too. There's the pitch. It's nice too.
Is that it? Is that the only place people can find you?
What do we do? Dinosaur Comics, RyanNorth.ca. RyanNorth.ca links to everything. You can find me. If you find that site, you found all my stuff. Oh, on Twitter, at RyanQNorth.
There we go.
Where I hang out and make... I made some bad jokes. Whew, DC Today, the woman who did the My Milkshake Brings All the Boys to the Yard song, you know the song I'm talking about? My Milkshake Brings All the Boys to the Yard? Yes? You know the song?
Yes, we know the
classic song. Yeah. There's like this fluff news story where she said, this is a quick aside, like, oh, she probably has never made a milkshake. She mostly prefers smoothies. And so the headline was, this woman has never made a milkshake. And I retweeted it with the comment, I could teach her, but I'd have to charge. Which is such an obvious joke and so horrible, but I could not make it. So all of this and more is yours at Ryan Q North.
Our guest has been Ryan North. Ryan, you're a great guy. It's always an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for coming back on the show. Everybody, go get Romeo and or Juliet. It's available for pre-order now and is on shelves June 7th. Thanks once again to Ryan North for joining us. Between that interview and our lengthy comics review segment, I think we're going to have to cut out the post-show listener question segment for this week. But you know what, Matt? Over the weekend, I think you and me will hit the Tumblr page, and we'll answer some questions from the backlog there to make up for it. So everybody can check out warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com for answers to your listener questions. And while you're there, you can always send us new ones.
That's right. You can also send us listener questions at warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. That's our email address, where you can also send us every story ever lists, panel president lists, as I said, listener questions, comments, or if you want to sponsor the show, you can let us know at that email address. Be sure to check out our website, which is warrocketajax.com. That is where you can stream the show, download the show, read show notes, and leave comments. Be sure to check us out on iTunes. If you go to iTunes and you search for War Rocket Ajax, that is where you'll find the show. If you like the show, leave us a review there. The more positive reviews we have on iTunes, the more we are featured. Now we've reached the part of the show where we tell you all the different places you can find us on the internet. For me, you can go to about.me/MattDWilson. You can find links to my Twitter, my Tumblr, and my books on Amazon. You can also go to Comixology and search for Copernicus Jones Robot Detective. That is my comic series with artist Kevin Warren. 7 issues are out now. Issue 8 is being worked on. Chris, where can everybody find you?
Everybody can find me at about.me/ChrisSims. You can find some links there to some stuff that I've done. I am the ISB on Twitter and Tumblr. And if you want a mystery box, chris@the-isb.com, email me. We'll talk. We'll talk about the bad packages I'm going to send you. No, they're good. I'm just kidding. Give me money. You can also find my stuff in your local comic book store. I am the co-writer of X-Men 92 from Marvel Comics, along with my writing partner, Chad Bowers, who I talked about a lot this week. And issue, I think this week, is number 4 that wraps up our first story arc. That's out on June 1st. So yeah, this week, in just a few days, you can read the climax of the Alpha Red story that we told in that comic. So yeah, that does it for War Rocket Ajax episode 306. Thanks once again to Ryan North. Thank you for listening and getting through that exhausting review of... of Rebirth. Matt, how do you think we did? I think we did okay.
I think we hit all the high points. We could have talked for another 20 minutes easy.
We should. I think we're going to launch a page by page podcast that's just about Rebirth. It's going to be an hour talking about each page every week for the next 80 weeks.
We could do it. We could do it.
We could easily do it. Oh boy. How that would solidify / ruin our friendship. Yeah, that does it, everybody. Have a great week. We'll be back with Ajax 307 next Monday afternoon. Have a good one, everybody.
Yeah!
All right, that's it for our comic segment.
I'm so tired.
I have no idea how I'm going to edit this.